Welcome to Women Are Fort Wayne, a local podcast highlighting the big picture issues we all face as women. Hey everybody, welcome back to Women Are Fort Wayne. I'm really excited to be here today with Stephanie Henry, who is a food systems activist. She is the director of Cultivation Lab, the chairwoman for Slow Food Wayne, a member of Hoosier Young Farmers, the Indiana Farmers Union, and the Food Council of Northeast Indiana. She's on the programming committee for the Local Food Forum, a grant reviewer for USDA SARE?
SARE,
okay. And was named one of Greater Fort Wayne Business Weekly's 40 Under 40 for 2019. And she's a lovely human, and I really enjoy spending time with her. So, hi, Stephanie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good, thanks.
It seems like a lot when you say it like that.
It kind of is a lot. You do so much. It's really inspiring. I remember I met you a couple years ago at a city council meeting, and I remember, like, from the second I saw you, you stood out as somebody who was showing up with so much composure and so much grace that I saw you across the room and was like, who's that? I want to know that person. She seems like she knows what's up and is really here to advocate for positive change.
And at the time, Hens, I believe.
It was. It was for the Urban Hens, yeah.
We're still working on that. We'll get there.
But in the meantime, I'm really glad that I was able to meet you that day.
Me too.
So thank you for being here today. To start with, what is a food systems activist? Because it's a term I don't think I'd heard before you said it.
Well, it's a term that I hadn't heard until somebody called me one. So I kind of came by it, I guess, naturally. I actually had to look it up, and there isn't necessarily a technical definition for food systems activists, but basically an activist working toward systems change. And for me, that's with a sustainability and a justice focus. So just unlike an environmental activist, a food systems activist is working on our food system.
That's amazing. So when you say our food system, what exactly do you mean by that?
By our food system, I mean all of the parts that go into what it takes to get food from seed to table. So farmers, producers, processors, transporters, restaurateurs, all of the different pieces. Eventually, hopefully we can get into all of the bits and pieces as far as seed providers and fertilizers and all of that sort of stuff, but all of the components that go into creating food and getting it from one point to the next and then eventually into your stomach.
So that's a really big, wide area of things and topics that you cover. What inspired you to get into this? What drove you towards food activism?
I kind of came by it naturally. I started out when I was young, I was in a food insecure household, so I was hungry a lot, and all I could think about all the time was how hungry I was and when the next time was I would eat. And, you know, school food was not always the greatest, and I'd still be hungry after lunch. And it just was very clear to me at a very young age how important food is for your development. And I always wanted to have my own farm-to-fork restaurant. And I was in college in the process of writing my business plan for my farm-to-fork restaurant, and I realized I didn't have any farmers. And when I started looking deeper into why there weren't farmers growing things that I could use in my restaurant, it opened up this whole world of issues. And that led to me starting a community garden. And when I did that, I found out about policy and ordinances and code and all of that fun stuff.
Okay, so let's back up just a little bit. So you grew up in a food insecure household, and that inspired you to want to start this farm-to-table restaurant. So when you started looking into finding these farms, what exactly did you find?
Well, I grew up around a lot of farms, and I just always assumed that my friends always had a bunch of stuff because, you know, they had like little gardens and stuff. And I just assumed that all of the fields of like corn was like fields of sweet corn and, you know, that sort of stuff. And I talked to a farmer friend of mine who was in pork and corn, and come to find out most of their pork goes overseas, and that all the corn was field corn, which was inedible and was used for feeding livestock or making ethanol or other other filler type things, but not that we could actually consume.
So all of these cornfields that I'm driving through in northeastern Indiana, most of them aren't actually edible?
No, and if you opened up an ear, it would not look like or smell like the corn that you're used to. It doesn't really have any taste, and it looks almost deformed sometimes. But yeah, it can be kind of funky.
Wow, I didn't know that before we started talking about this. That's
kind of
astonishing, really. I mean, to be surrounded by farmland and not have it be a sustainable ecosystem that can actually support human life is strange.
Well, that's why food deserts are an issue for rural communities as well as urban communities. Food deserts are areas where people don't have ready access to food that they can eat. So it happens a lot in rural communities where it looks like they're surrounded by food because they're surrounded by fields of growing things. But whether it's corn or soybeans or sorghum or whatever, the majority of that is not edible. Well, sorghum is, but...
And I mean, this is, I'm not good with terminology. This is why I'm having somebody like you on my show. But I know that there's a big issue as far as like having a sustainable ecosystem with, is it called monocropping?
Yep.
Cool, I got that right.
Monocropping is something that became really popular, especially in the 80s, where they started pushing the grow field fence row to fence row and planting the same thing. And they went from small tractors to really, really large tractors and specialized combines. And they have these huge, big machines that are really good for doing one thing, for one crop and one crop only. And that became, you know, the whole push in the 80s. And the monocropping, you know, you didn't have to worry about different things for different plants or different kind of pesticides. All that stuff. You lay out all the same stuff, you treat it all the same way, you go through it with one big thing. It seemed like a really great way to go.
Seems really efficient.
But it's not.
And why isn't it?
Well, that's a complicated issue. long story short, it's not good for the environment. It's not good for the land. And it's ultimately not good for the farmers, because then that's why we have so many farm subsidies. That's why we're at the mercy of this international food market and commodity market, where if, say, I don't know, China stops buying all of our farm goods, then we have nowhere to sell these things that are normally been sold in China or something like that, and they've got nothing else to sell. Another issue that's a problem is that's very current is this spring, when we had record levels of rainfall, corn has to get in at a certain time, and there are certain times for insurance purposes that they have to have corn in the ground in order to have it covered by insurance. Because of the levels of water still in the fields, a lot of them couldn't get the corn in on time. And so they had to go fall back to the next thing that could go in. And, you know, it has to be in the ground so long before it's ready to harvest. And our growing season is only so long. So a lot of them resorted to possibly planting soybeans. The ones that were lucky and ended up getting their fields dried out in time planted a lot of soybeans and hoping that that will make it through to harvest in time. But a lot of farmers couldn't even get that in.
So what are those farmers going to do?
They're very worried right now.
I can imagine. And I mean, I've seen the effects of this even locally. I go to the farmers market every weekend, and it wasn't until like 2 weeks ago that there was much produce at all. And usually there is months ahead of that. And I think that's a result of climate change, right?
I would say so.
Yeah.
I've noticed I have a small urban farm where I grow things on an experimental sort of status, and I didn't get my tomatoes in until very late, and that was because every time I got the ground ready, it would rain and rain and rain, and then I couldn't get anything in. And so I still don't have any ripe produce on mine either, but it's something that I've seen increasing over the last couple of years for sure.
Yeah. So you started this urban, is it an urban garden or a community garden? I know you mentioned it a few minutes ago, but I'm not remembering.
It's an urban educational space.
Oh, that sounds cool.
It's technically my backyard, but it's a quarter acre in the heart of the city. And I do experimental growing plans out there. I will talk to people on Facebook or Instagram or whatever who are like, hey, have you tried growing potatoes in a sack? Have you tried growing these using bean poles and, you know, intercropping things and that sort of stuff? And so I've experimented and taken pictures and had, you know, little meetings with people where we discuss all the things that you can grow in an urban setting. And it's surprising to a lot of people how many how many pounds of produce you can get from a small plot in the city. I have over 100 tomato plants in right now.
Wow, that's a lot. On a quarter acre, you said?
Quarter acre. That's small. Well, and it's not even fully tilled.
Huh. That's incredible. I would love to come see that at some point.
Sure.
Do you have pictures of it that you could send us for the show notes?
It looks a little raggedy this year.
Okay.
It's I'm experimenting with letting things grow up and doing more of a no-till, but it's kind of difficult when you don't have the black plastic. So I have a lot of grassy weeds that are kind of growing up that make it look not so great, but it's actually helping because it keeps the pests from getting to the tomatoes too much.
That makes
sense. So they're able to ripen without being disturbed as much. It just doesn't look as pretty as some of my other gardens. I can share pictures from some other years when it was more manicured.
I would love that.
I can do that.
Awesome. So we'll make sure to have those in the show notes for you. So you had this community garden, and that inspired you to start seeing what was happening with policy. How did that transition happen?
Well, it started with the community garden, with just installing the community garden. I met my neighbors because I asked to borrow some tools, and it turned out he was the president of the neighborhood association.
Oh, cool. That's convenient.
Sort of.
or inconvenient, maybe?
Well, he introduced me to codes and zoning and ordinances and that sort of stuff, and explained that we couldn't just put a garden anywhere, that it looked like there was an empty lot. But we worked together with the neighborhood association in Williams Woodland Park neighborhood, and partnered with the Rialto, at the time was the Reclamation Project, and they let us use their back parking lot. And we were able to do a lot of things, but because of the way that the zoning and the codes were, we weren't able to put a shed up. We had difficulties getting water access, and it was very frustrating trying to put this garden in. And then as I continued to work and consult with other neighborhoods who were trying to do similar gardens, we kept running into the same problems, that the lots were too small to put a shed on, but too big to just leave abandoned. Mm-hmm. And so that got me interested in codes and zoning. I did take a break, though, from gardens because I got a little frustrated.
It sounds like a frustrating process.
Well, and I was working in hospitality at the time. I was working in restaurants, which wasn't as stable. And so I took a job in plastics manufacturing as a document controller and internal auditor, which...
Oh, interesting.
Sounds completely unrelated. And in a way, it is very completely unrelated.
What kind of plastics manufacturing were you doing?
Automotive.
Okay.
So we were ISO certified, and that was one of my jobs, was to create the process plans and to go out and do audits and to ensure that we were producing things according to our process plans and all of that sort of stuff. And it really gave me a stronger understanding of how process works and procedures and why that's important for, you know, continuity, for checking things, that sort of stuff. And that led to me understanding how policy could really maybe solve some of the problems that we had with the gardens. And so I was like, well, if it's this easy to change the process for producing this piece for this car, I wonder if there's a similar process for changing the policy and the codes and ordinance for how we deal with this piece of property.
What a creative way to take what you were doing for work and translate it to what your passion project was. So you started to realize that you could make change to the policies that were causing you the challenges with your gardens. What happened then? How did you take that to the next step?
Well, I started going to conferences, and I took a job with a school where we were doing a pilot program where our students were growing things in a controlled environment system in a greenhouse. And we also got some chicken coops, or we got a chicken coop, we got a couple of beehives, and then we also started a mushroom tent. And so I worked with the children. We were writing processes for how they, you know, make the fertigation, how they check the temperatures on things, how they do the seeding and transplanting, and then the whole process all the way through to harvesting and then selling that stuff. And so while I was doing that, I also was attending conferences. And going to different seminars on food service or food safety on the farm, which is called FSMA. So it's the Food Safety Modernization Act, FSMA. And that just got me really excited about learning more about what is that blueprint, what is that procedure that's laid out for all of the gardens, all the plans. I'm like, this has to go to a different level. It's more than just the local things. It's more than even just the regional things. There's more to it. And so at the conferences, I ran into a lovely young lady. And in talking with her, she was a grant reviewer for SARE. And it was a grant that I was interested in applying for because it was for farmers and ranchers. And it's one of the only grants that goes directly from the federal government to farmers and is peer reviewed by farmers. And so in talking with her, she told me that there was an opening and that would be a great way for me to get some experience and some knowledge in that sort of area. And so I took that opportunity, and that just opened me up to more opportunities to go to conferences and to learn more. And in the process of doing that, I learned about the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition, which is NSAC, which is a national organization that is a policy body that has a coalition of over 140 members around the country. And they write policy briefs for sustainable agriculture. And I was looking on their website, looking for information on how to craft policy, how to change policy, what are some examples of good policy in different cities that have more vibrant, sustainable food environments. And that's when I found out about the internship opportunity.
So we'll come back to that in a second, but backing up. So what you mentioned that you were working at a school. What school were you at?
I was working at the Crossing School of Business and Entrepreneurship.
Okay, and they had this whole farm program?
The Crossing model is a 50-50 model where the students do school for 50% of the time, and then they all do 50% in a work environment where we have a school in Master Spas where the students work at Master Spas. Some of the students work for a company that we've started that makes the pallets that Master Spas uses to sell their hot tubs on. Okay. And so they're in charge of getting the materials together, writing the procedure, measuring them out, cutting them, assembling them. Then they have to get inspected. Then they actually sell those pallets to Master Spas. And then the money from that goes to help to support the school and the students.
That sounds like a really incredible program to have been working with.
It was. And I really enjoyed it. Unfortunately, our campus that had the greenhouses was one of the only rural campuses that we had. And we had some challenges with transportation and financing for the campus. So unfortunately, the school component of that campus closed. But a couple of the students who worked in the program actually took jobs with the company that has the greenhouses and are continuing to do work there.
Oh, that's beautiful. So you're working for the school, you start to learn about policy on a bigger level, you start to do this research, and it leads you to this internship opportunity. And that was with NSAC. So tell us a bit about the internship.
Well, it came about at exactly the right time. Unfortunately, like I said, we ran into funding problems with our campus and transportation problems, so they ended up closing that campus. And I was looking at having to find a new job around the holidays. And at that time, I found out about the internship opportunities at NSAC, where there's a grassroots intern and there's a policy intern. And since I've done all of my roots in grassroots, I decided I'll give it a shot. What's the chances that I'll win? And the next thing I know, I'm getting a call saying, you're a finalist. We'd like to have an interview. And I'm kind of getting a little nervous just talking about it. But the grant review that I do for SARE is 30 years old. And they have a conference every 10 years. So at their 30th anniversary conference, where I'm surrounded by all of these people who are working in sustainable agriculture, it's like a who's who of like sustainable agriculture people, I get a phone call from NSAC saying, we want you to be our intern. And I lost it. I think I started crying. And then I went over to the table where some of the NSAC people were, and I'm like, hi, I think I might be your intern.
Aww.
I had no idea what I was doing or how I was going to make it work because it was an internship in DC. Uh-huh. Luckily, it was a paid internship.
That's good.
But not paid a lot.
And Washington, DC is expensive.
It is. And then to make it more complicated, I insisted on keeping my house here in Fort Wayne because I really care about Northeast Indiana. I really care about Fort Wayne. It is my hometown, and I wanted to have it to come back to because it was supposed to be a three-month internship, and I didn't want to leave my house and then not have anywhere to come back to after 3 months because I knew if I did that, I probably wouldn't come back. And so when I got the internship, I was paying to live in D.C. as well as to keep my house here.
Wow.
In Fort Wayne. It was a little tight.
I can imagine.
But it was an incredible experience. Being in D.C. was insane. I was working on the Farm Bill, and the Farm Bill in itself is a whole other creature. The Farm Bill started in 1934. It was in response to the Dust Bowl and to the Great Depression. We were losing our soil. People were starving. You know, farmers were out of money, losing farms left and right. So the Farm Bill was first created for conservation and to feed people. And then over the years, different chapters have been added to it. And it's kind of hard to understand, but somewhere buried in there is some language that has to do with like urban agriculture and horticulture and beginning farmers and that sort of stuff. And I needed to know more about that. And I couldn't find anyone here who really knew about that. So going to DC, I got to, I remember it was like my second week when the House put out their version of the bill, which was the first time that it had been put out. And I remember that as NSAC, we got access to pieces of legislation. We were part of a group of organizations that get access to that a little bit early, like newspapers and whatnot, so we can see it and start to make responses to it. And I just remember holding it and thinking, this is it. This is what I came out here for, was so that I could see, you know, this is where the buck stops. This is where all the programming comes from, that sets the tone for the whole country. And so I spent 6 months studying it and organizing around encouraging them to support different sections of it. You know, we were fighting to keep different provisions in the Farm Bill. We were fighting to make sure that the subsidies weren't too big, you know, and really just getting a deep dive into the Farm Bill. You know, they say like drinking from a fire hose. I like to say that DC was like someone ran over the hydrant and you're just straight in the hydrant, because it went from a trickle of information out here to just this full hydrant of information out there. But it was incredible. It allowed me the opportunity to really advocate for Northeast Indiana, for Indiana in general. It's surprising how many people out there are like, you guys grow things in Indiana? Oh, we didn't know that. And I'm just like, but we all think of ourselves as like farmers and corn, and no one out there really sees us as like growing things. So
that is surprising. I mean, what do they think that we do out here?
I don't know. I don't know. But I got to advocate for like our beginning farmers and training, our Burmese population. Mm-hmm. I got to talk with the Office of Management and Budgets, which is the one that actually determines kind of the dollar amounts on things. Mm-hmm. It's basically the accountants for the president, more or less, is how I think of it.
Okay.
I could be wrong on that. But I actually got to talk to them, and these are people who work at USDA and whatever else. And I got to talk to them about, you know, why it was important to keep the funding for these programs in place, not only in place, but then to also increase the funding for the programs. And knowing that I was talking to the people who really had the final say in it, and it was being heard, that was really incredible.
So how does that actually impact our local populations?
So what we did was we fought for the bill, which was to lay out the framework. And then we had to fight for the appropriations, which is the amount of money that is set aside and that is allocated for it. Mm-hmm. And now we're in the most important part. The Farm Bill happens every 4 to 5 years.
Okay.
So after getting it written, after getting the appropriations, now we're at the most important step, which is the implementation step, which is why I had to come back here.
Okay.
Because now that it's in writing and they've mandated money for it, now it's our turn to write applications for programs to get that money to do that programming.
Okay.
So I came back here so that I could talk to all the organizations that are working on various things and let them know there is money for these programs. There is support for training new beginning farmers. There is support for transitioning farmers to put their land in kind of a trust, if you want to. And one of the challenges with farming right now is that we're looking at a huge loss of farmers. The median age of farmers right now is 48 to 52.
Okay, so a little bit older. Or is that a little bit younger?
Is it 58 to 62? I think it's 58 to 62.
Okay.
It's 58 to 62. So the median age is 58 to 62, and we're looking at hundreds of thousands of acres of land that's going to be transitioning hands the next 10 years. Mm-hmm. But we have less than 1% of our population actively engaged in farming. And most of those farmers don't have somebody else on the farm. They don't have kids on the farm. They don't have anyone to turn it over to. And they've been doing this commodity monocropping for so long that they have a lot of money sunk into equipment and inputs and seeds and all of that sort of stuff, it's really hard for them to transition. So that's why things like hemp is important, because hemp is a transition crop that can help to get out of putting so many chemicals into the ground, growing something that's more natural that can be used for a lot of different purposes, mm-hmm. but that can also help to transition that farmer into a more natural growing process and possibly diversify their farm. So we're looking at a lot of challenges. There's not a lot of farmers who are doing things. So that's why it's important to do programming to connect existing existing farmers with existing land with new beginning farmers who want to take over the land. But we have to put some sort of piece in place so that new farmers don't have the money that they would need to buy out existing farmers and all their equipment and all that stuff. And frankly, most of them don't want all that stuff because they don't want to do that monocropping. They want to diversify. So we've got to figure out how to make those two ends meet, which is a challenge mm-hmm. that, you know, needs to be met through the implementation process.
And that's why this legislation exists, presumably, right?
To give, yeah, it's part of why we fought for this legislation, to give mm-hmm. us the framework to be able to craft programming and have some support for it.
So what are some of the projects you're working on now?
Well, I have a number of projects right now. The problem is we don't have a lot of people who are working in this particular sector of food systems, sustainable food systems in this area. We have a lot of commercial and commodity crop type folks. But working in the sustainable sector is a little bit more lonesome out here. Mm-hmm. So I wear a lot of hats for a lot of different organizations, but it's kind of a good thing because I bring a continuity. I bring the same discussion points from one organization to the next. So that ensures that, we're all working towards the same goals using the same language, which leads to my biggest project right now, which is our food charter. There is a coalition of food councils across the state of Indiana who've gotten together, and we are working on drafting a food charter.
And so what exactly, for the uninitiated, is a food charter?
That's part of what we're figuring out, because food charters can be a lot of different things to a lot of different places. We've taken a long time. We've been working on this for over a year now, where we're examining food charters from different states, Michigan, Maryland, Minnesota, Virginia. We're looking at their food charters. We're looking at how they were put together, what they were meant to address, and what their values are and how they were meant to be used. You know, are we using this as a roadmap? Are we using this as a piece of legislation? Are we using this as just a, here's a good idea of what to do? And what we've settled on is we've settled on something that's along the lines of a roadmap and with some common language and some goals. So our food charter is going to have some definitions of what a food charter is and can be, food deserts, things like that, so people can have a bit of a glossary and have a bit of an understanding of what these terminologies are and how they're used. We're going to have a bit of an assessment of what our situation is here in the state. Mm-hmm. And then we're also going to have sections like some recommendations on what you can do within your own city, your township, your region, like starting a food council, participating in a food council, working with your legislators. And then hopefully we'll also have some pieces in there that are some recommendation pieces for that can be used to either draft a non-binding resolution or perhaps to draft some legislation itself. But this is just being put forward as a guideline so that we all have some common talking points, because we have groups from north, south, east, and west in Indiana that are working on pretty much the same thing, but they were saying it slightly differently. Mm-hmm. And what that was causing was a lot of confusion and a lot of misunderstanding. Because it's like, well, you said this, but it sounds like this other thing. And it's like, okay, like our food council is the food council of Northeast Indiana, whereas the food council on the other side of the state is the Northwest Indiana Food Council. Mm-hmm. Little things, little differences like that can be confusing for some people.
Sure.
So writing the food charter gives us a common roadmap for us to use to write things, for us to draft legislation, for us to have conversations about procurement, you know, whether it's procurement in schools mm-hmm. or procurement in our public offices.
Okay.
You know, the city.
So when you say procurement, what does that mean?
Food buyers.
Okay.
So when they're buying food from the schools or for the schools, there are certain rules that regulate what they can spend it on. Now, okay. There's been a lot of work on a federal level that changes the regulations on how to get more local food into schools. That's some of the stuff that we were fighting for that's in the Farm Bill.
Okay.
And so that's one section of things that's in the Farm Bill. That's
so
under
that's creating some guidance so that like a school has to buy a certain amount of it local. Is that what you mean?
Yep. It's okay. Saying that in order to participate in the program, a school has to spend 10 cents on every meal from locally produced goods.
Okay. That sounds like it's a good way to incentivize buying local and get some farmers making stuff that we can actually eat.
And that's the challenge, is that we have farmers who are getting into diversified farming and who are wanting to grow things that we can eat, but they don't have those large customers to go to their bank and say, hey, I need to expand by X amount so that I can produce this amount because I have this customer. So the banks aren't giving them the loans that they need to grow their business because they can't demonstrate that there's a need. If we can change that, if we can change the procurement plans, if we can change the food buying patterns within our community, especially within, you know, municipal offices, within our schools, those are two really big institutional buyers. If we can put even small changes into that, in those procedures, then that will be big orders for farmers. And then the next step is to talk with the bankers and make sure they understand that their products need to reflect, you know, this new need. Mm-hmm. But it's very complicated. It's one step at a time. But hopefully what it ultimately will lead to is more fresh fruits and vegetables in our schools for our kids and more business for our local farmers and farm families so that they can stay on the land and that they can, you know, farm sustainably and healthily with their families as well.
That's going to solve so many problems. And I mean, it seems like a small thing, but it's not a small thing.
That's why working on policy gets me really excited, because ultimately it comes down to having lots of conversations and working with words. Mm-hmm. And you're working with words and writing words down, but ultimately those words make a big difference, and the way that you can word something can make the difference that can save a farm or put a farm out of business.
That's really significant work that you're doing. I'm really excited to learn more about the food charter as it comes together.
Yeah, we've got we're still a couple of years out. You know, normally food charters, you know, can take anywhere from 3 to 5 years or more, depending on what sort of resources are going into them. Right now, we're doing ours very grassroots. We don't have a lot of funding for it. Everyone's really doing it as a volunteer basis. Mm-hmm. we're all very passionate about it, but we're working on, as the word gets around, we're working on some partnerships that will hopefully bring a little bit more impetus, a little bit more brain power to it, so that we can speed up the process a little bit. And then hopefully, you know, this is an election year, and I know it's something that I've talked about with candidates and something that I continue to talk about with politicians and business owners and candidates. But as we get different people into offices, you know, and even working with existing, you know, policymakers, you know, to get them to, it's a tool. Like, here's how we can lay out, you know, something for you to work on, and give them very clear instructions on how they can do something that makes a big difference.
So in addition to the food charter, you have a couple of other projects. Can you tell me a bit about Cultivation Lab?
Cultivation Lab is a work in progress. It started as a consulting firm, but it's taking shape more as a think tank, because I need more brains at work on this. I've reached out to some people from some of the colleges, and I'm hoping to get some students, some interns, to be able to work with me on parts of the parts of the food charter that I'm drafting, but also some local legislation. But that's still in the works. And then another project that I've been working on is Slow Food. We actually just started a chapter of Slow Food.
And what is Slow Food?
So Slow Food is an international organization that's dedicated to good, clean, and fair food for all. And they work on that from several different approaches, whether it's slow fish, slow meat. There's Slow Food Nations, which has to do with like chefs, mm-hmm. Getting together and cooking food that's more natural. Our chapter is focusing on slow meat, farm to school, and food policy.
Awesome. And that's, how can people get involved with that if they're interested too?
We just started a Facebook page. We are working on some upcoming meetings. Two of my partners in starting Slow Food, one just kicked off a beverage company and the other one has three food trucks.
Which beverage company?
Bucal Beverage.
Oh, Robert's awesome.
He is.
Hi, Robert. I hope you're listening.
So Robert and Joseph Ellison are my partners. So Joseph just opened up yet another food truck.
Which food truck?
He's got Head and Hawk and Localvore.
Oh, awesome. I love Head and Hawk.
Yep, as well as his company, 3R Bone Broth. So they also do bone broth.
Okay, awesome.
So he's very busy. So all three of us have been very busy since launching it. But we're looking forward to getting some events going as the season starts to wind down. And those will be public events where people can come and meet with us. And we're going to talk about all things food related that you want to talk about, but the things that we're the most specialists in are going to be the farm to school, the policy, and the slow meat. Hopefully as we grow our membership and interest and that sort of stuff, we can have more substantive conversations about other things that people are also interested in.
So we've talked about a lot of the different things that you're working on and a bunch of the different ways that you're influencing this idea of diversifying our farming. Why does this matter? Why on a bigger picture level is it important for us to be diversifying our farms? Aside from being able to have more farm to table restaurants.
Yeah.
Which are awesome.
For me, it sounds kind of silly. I never watched, The Walking Dead, uh-huh. But I always use The Walking Dead as a metaphor. So if there was a zombie...
I think that it's meant to be a metaphor. I mean, honestly, the zombie apocalypse is a metaphor for infrastructure collapse.
Pretty much. So if there was a zombie apocalypse, if there was an infrastructure collapse, if there was a catastrophic event like a hurricane, tornado, you know, earthquake in so many of the places that we rely on for our food products, you know, we don't have a backup. And if there was a zombie apocalypse, we would be less than a week before we'd be out of food. So
less than a week.
Yeah.
Wow,
the grocery stores can't supply, could not stay going. No.
Huh.
Yeah. We would be in trouble really fast.
That's more dismal than I even realized.
And so you think about if something catastrophic was to happen, say there was an EMP bomb that went off, and even just in a localized area, you know, like our state suddenly has no power, you know, like where would you go for your food and vegetables? Where would you go for things? Well, the grocery store is only going to have stuff for so long before that goes bad. And then where do you go? If we don't have diversified farms, if we don't have some urban production, if we don't have, you know, a combination, it's not just urban or rural, it has to be a combination. We have to be growing things both where we live, but also outside where we can grow things in a larger capacity to supply. I mean, because being able to get to that food, you know, as well as being able to process it, we're looking at a really rough situation. So I also, caveat, I do historical reenactment, and I do historical reenactment because I want to be prepared if something like that happens.
That's really smart.
Yeah, I want to know how to make my cheese. I want to know how to butcher an animal, that sort of stuff. And I also want to know the other people who know how to do it better than me.
And our culture has gotten so far away from that. People don't know how to process their own food, and they don't know how to interact with the process of creating food.
Yeah.
And I don't mean cooking. I mean actually creating things for us to eat.
Yeah, whether it's, you know, grinding grain, making pasta, making bread, making cheese, you know, things like that. A lot of people really don't know how to do that, which is kind of sad. And I really enjoy doing my historical reenactment. It's a lot of fun. I do a lot of mead making and that sort of stuff. So I figure out the important things because when everything goes down, you need a cocktail.
So true. So true.
Not that I'm endorsing just getting drunk, but just saying.
You know, there's a reason that, I mean, and mead in particular, isn't that like the oldest known alcohol?
Yeah. And it has antibacterial properties. So
so it's actually good for you.
Yes.
So if people are wanting to learn more about the work that you're doing and how to get more educated or involved around this stuff, what are some places they can visit or some books they can read? Where would you direct people?
Well, my very first place would be to go to the NSAC website. It's sustainableagriculture.net.
Okay.
And they have an incredible wealth of information. And I'm not just saying that because I worked for them, but I worked for them because I am just impressed by everything that they have. They do really great write-ups on all of the stuff. You can go to their blog and, search any item that you want and come up with some articles that will break it down for you. They're hyperlinked, so you can go directly from an article that tells you about a program directly to applying for a grant. And it has all of the deadlines. It has links to all of their partner organizations. So depending on what you're interested in, you can find someone who's working on that stuff through the NSAC website. That is kind of like my encyclopedia sustainability.
Awesome. I'm definitely gonna go poke around on there.
And sign up for their newsletter. Their newsletters, they don't put a ton of stuff that you don't really need in there, but they're always something that's relevant and current to what's going on. There's a few books that I will probably share with you that you can put in the show notes that I use for references.
Okay.
A lot of what I use is probably not great reading unless, the Farm Bill was, I think, 806 pages or something like that.
Oh, wow, that's a lot.
I went through and highlighted all the relevant sections. At least the relevant for me at this time. But a lot of the stuff that I use is more reference type. It's not necessarily easy reading, but I do have a few books on food systems and why those are important for someone who perhaps has an economy background and would like to be more interested in how local diversified food systems can help the economy.
Okay, cool. Yeah, we'll definitely have that in the show notes for any of you that are interested in it. So if people want to find Slow Food, how can they find you?
We have a Facebook page,
Okay.
and we will be getting more active on there as we get closer to some more events.
Okay, awesome. And if people want to learn more about Cultivation Lab, where can they find information on that?
Cultivation Lab, as of yet, is still in a development phase. So we do not have a website up at the moment.
Okay.
But when that is up, I will definitely send you an update for that.
Okay, and listeners, when I get that from her, I will make a social media post so that you all can see it.
And then you can also follow me on Twitter.
Okay, awesome. And what's your handle?
It's FW Agvocate, so AGVOCATE, because I'm an advocate for ag.
Nice. Nice play on words.
I like word puns. I like all the little planting of seeds and metaphors and all of those things because it's very relevant.
It is. It is. And I'm also a fan of that. I used to use gardening metaphors in my yoga classes all the time.
Hey, they're relevant for so many things.
So, I think that brings us to the end of our recording. Was there any final thoughts that you wanted to share with everyone today?
Local food tastes better.
Local food does taste better. I've noticed that.
It does. It's got more nutrient content and it's got love built in.
Thank you so much for being here today, Stephanie.
Thank you for having me, Stephanie.
You're very, very welcome.
So I'm just gonna go. You're great.
No, you're great.
No,
No, you're great.
Hey, this is Matt Kelly. Love listening to the podcast and just wanted to recommend Olivia Fabian for it. Olivia's led a really fascinating life, and all those experiences she's had has kind of formed this like really wildly diverse set of skills that she has that apply to like really awesome projects and initiatives in the city. And I suppose like from a shout out perspective, I personally benefit from her skills as a coworker at One Lucky Guitar, but also just as a resident of the community. I think this place is better and more vibrant and I think weirder with her in it, and that's pretty cool. Hey, thanks. See ya.
Thank you so much for that shout out. That was really, really wonderful. And yes, I definitely am interested in talking with Olivia. So, Olivia, if you're listening, I'll be reaching out to you pretty soon. If there's somebody in your life that you would like to give a little extra appreciation to, a woman who has made your experience of Fort Wayne better, please feel free to call in. Our voicemail number is 260-355-5734. It is just a voicemail, so you can call any time of day and nobody will pick up. You just leave your message. If you don't like how it sounds, you can always tell me so in the recording and I will scrap it. You can call back and re-record if you want to. And if there's
If you're feeling uncomfortable about having a recorded message of your voice for any reason whatsoever, please feel free to write me. You can either send me an email at womenarefortwayne@gmail.com or send me a message on Facebook or Instagram, and I'll read what you have to say on the air. So before we wrap things up today, I want to spend... I say spend every single time. I am laughing at myself right now. Before we wrap things up, I would like to send a very special thank you to Steve and Radiance with Silver Birch Studios for giving us such an incredible home this season. We are so grateful for your support. I would also like to send a thank you to Rosalind and the Way for providing us with our gorgeous intro music. You can find them at www.rosalindandtheway.com. They're also on Facebook, Instagram, Spotify, and CD Baby. And an extra special thank you to Tracy, who has done such an incredible job with helping us with our recording and editing. She is the best co-founder that I could possibly ask for on this endeavor. And today was a little extra special because she's been training me on how to actually use the recording equipment, and she does so much hard stuff, and neither of us have a background in sound engineering, so she's learned so much to do this project. If you have any feedback or ideas or guest recommendations, please feel free to call or email, and make sure that you are following us on Facebook and Instagram for updates about upcoming episodes and other things that are happening in our community. So to wrap things up today, our featured musician is Sunny Taylor. She is a folk rock artist with 4 albums and a wide range of music. Around town, she teaches, performs, mentors young musicians, and volunteered to start a music program at the Crossing School. I loved listening to her albums on Spotify this week and was absolutely delighted to find this hidden gem as a bonus track at the end of her Lock the Door and Leave album. The song is called Gypsy, and the lyrics spilled out of her one day after she bought a pair of boots. The song was inspired by her past experiences of not quite fitting in and having people make false assumptions about who she was, thinking she was weird or on drugs when she was just shy and battling anxiety. As somebody who battles anxiety myself, I completely relate to this, and the song really, really resonated. You can listen to her music on iTunes and Spotify. And she has many shows coming up. She's performing very, very frequently. So make sure to check out her Facebook page. There's a link in the show notes. And find out when she's performing next and see if you can come out and see her. So without any further ado, I give you Gypsy. And in the meantime, have a great week. And next week, we will be back for our season finale with Jody Lehman talking about environmentalism. Have a great week.
I got my boots on my feet, I feel my life is complete, but I'm tired of playing games that I always lose. I got some rings on my fingers, but none they promise to lose. So I think that it's time that I do what I choose. Live, you got your suit and tie, you got your sun in the sky, you got everything I never wanted anyway. You think you can change my weather with the push of a button, amen. Maybe we'll meet again someday. Welcome my friends to my life, I ain't a bad girl after all. Stand again, but I'll always land upon. Live. Confusing. up for. I ain't no gypsy, but I steal your heart if you got something to give. I don't have time to be your lover, cause I got a life to live.